Welcome to the LSI Behind the Wind podcast. My name is Sean Slattern. For 30 years, I've dedicated my life to the science of business development. I've seen the impact of our work, which has evolved into economic development and now social impact. And in this episode, I'm joined by Elizabeth. We call her Sissy DeWitt. She is one of our graphic artists and someone that I really admire. In our conversation, we talk a lot about creativity and how we have incorporated graphic art into our business development methodology. I think you'll find this a fascinating conversation between Sissy and me, and I hope you enjoy this discussion. Sissy, I'm so excited to have you as my guest this morning. I've been excited to have this conversation with you, and you have been one of the individuals that we have wanted to talk with for a couple of years. You had been on my list of individuals that I really admire, and so thanks for being a part of this.
No, thank you for the kind words, and thank you for having me.
So before we start, I've got a number of questions for you, but just talk about your background and your history, and how did you end up in this world of art?
So that's a really long and complicated story.
I'll start with this. Give us your background.
Okay. So originally from Canada, from Quebec, and my parents immigrated there from Austria. So, and my two brothers as well. So I was the first one in my family to be born in Canada. And yeah, so we were raised there, and eventually we immigrated to the States, to Pennsylvania. And I went to high school in Pennsylvania, and then went to Penn State and studied business in Penn State, which was a disaster. Business is not something that really comes easy for me. So it was a big struggle. And I struggled for quite a bit. And also what I did when I was young, I worked at a veterinary hospital, and I always worked at a veterinary hospital. So when I finally got out from under the whole business thing, I was working as you know, a helper in a veterinary clinic. And so I decided to take veterinary classes. And so I did my pre-vet and also worked, you know, as a vet tech, and then applied for veterinary school, and then had kind of this sort of come to Jesus moment, I guess, and decided that maybe being a veterinarian was a little bit too heartbreaking for me, because I cried a lot. I mean, it was really hard. It was, so then I went to my parents and I said, listen, I don't think I can do this. And I think I want to be an artist. And you can only imagine how well that went over.
Okay, so let me stop you. What, first of all, how old were you when you left Quebec?
Let's see. I think I was, 12, I think? 12 or 13? Yeah.
So very, you'd spent most of your childhood in Canada, in Quebec, and then moved to Pennsylvania. Was that traumatic?
In a sense, yes. I did love Canada a lot, and I still do. And it was pretty nice. It was, you know, Pennsylvania didn't really appeal to me all that much. It was a hard place for me. I think, you know, I think about it a lot, you know, when I think back of, you know, like where, you know, like I grew up. I mean, I grew up in Pennsylvania as well, you know, but it didn't have like the same energy, or, you know, like it didn't really feel like home where Quebec did. And so we went back often. I mean, we were there a lot. We had a cabin up north, about an hour north of Montreal in the Laurentians. And so we spent a lot of time up there, and our summers were up there. And in fact, well, my family's still up there, and my brother just bought another cabin up there last year. So yeah, we're still, you know, we still are very, very connected to that area. Where we lived in Pennsylvania, there's no connection whatsoever. So yeah,
So you moved there when you're 13 and finished high school in the U.S. and became a U.S. citizen while you were a teenager, I assume?
No, I didn't become a citizen until, this is kind of a funny story, but so I was always an Austrian citizen because my parents were Austrian. And then I met Dominic, my future husband. He was a Belgian citizen. And we thought, well, you know, just in case he wanted to immigrate to the States as well, because he was a Belgian citizen, I became a U.S. citizen like 6 days before we married.
I didn't know that. I thought you became a citizen when you were a kid. And okay, interesting.
Yeah. So we traveled back and forth quite a bit. So we just all stayed Austrian citizens. And then, and with Canada, it was really easy too. I also had a Canadian passport. And so it was really easy to kind of go back and forth. And I mean, it never was an issue until, you know, Dominic was like, you know, I think, you know, it would be easier if you were a U.S. citizen. And so, yeah, but it didn't go over with the INS very well, which is now the ICE. So we were interviewed quite a bit and, you know, we really had to go through that whole process because they really thought, you know, we were only getting married for the green card, you know, so we had to go through quite a bit and we finally did, pass, but boy, it was a little bit nerve wracking there in the beginning because they really thought, you know, that we were trying to pull one over. I mean, yeah, 6 days before marriage, you know, that's kind of.
So going back to your history, you spent your teenage years in Pennsylvania, went to Penn State, thinking you were going to go into business and then vet school. And then you just had this decision that you really were an artist at heart and that you were going to pursue art.
Yeah. And it's really funny, you know, I've always been an artist and, you know, and it was a different generation at that point as well. You know, it was always that idea that, okay, you're never going to really have a career in art. It was more like a hobby sort of a thing, which, you know, of course that's changed. But at that time, it was kind of this thing, you know, that my parents were like, oh, come on, you know, art is something you're really good at, but it's not a career. But yeah, that changed. I had a couple of really, really good professors that told me otherwise and said, no, you know, you can survive as an artist and you can do it.
So you and I have known each other for a long time now. And yeah. I've admired your work and I have a lot of your pieces and you've done so many amazing special pieces for me, for the company, for some of our civic organizations that we both love. And so can you talk about now you've had this long career as an artist and, you know, what talk about this path that you chose in pursuing art as a career.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So I went to school to be a designer and, you know, so I kind of went into the more commercial line of art. So it was design and illustration. And so I did my undergrad and then decided to go to graduate school as well. And during graduate school for a tuition waiver, you can teach, you know, some 10-10 classes and, you know, they kind of, you know, let you dabble a little bit in teaching. And for some reason, you know, I taught my first class and I was hooked, absolutely hooked. So, and I never left. I'm still there. I'm still at, you know, the same building that I started, you know, my graduate work in. But my graduate work was focused on the birds of the Great Salt Lake. And I chose that and a lot of my choices in, you know, undergrad and graduate school had to do a lot with animals and, you know, because of my veterinary background. So So I thought, well, if I'm not going to be a veterinarian, if that is too hard, you know, if that's too heartbreaking for me, I was going to try to help and also serve that purpose of, you know, my love for animals. So I was always kind of focused on that sort of direction. So you'll notice in my work, most of it has some sort of aspect of either the environment or animals, mostly animals and mostly birds. And moths, you know, I really have a thing for anything that flies.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I guess I figured if I couldn't save the world as a doctor, I was going to save it as an artist. So
I love that. You've told me this story before that your focus was the birds of the Great Salt Lake. Talk about that study a bit more.
So I was really fortunate when I was in grad school, a local author who is one of my absolute heroes is Terry Tempest Williams. And she had written a book called Refuge. And I had read it a few years before that. And I loved the book. I mean, it made me fall in love with Utah, like 100%. It was really a beautiful, beautiful book. And so while I was at grad school at the U, I heard that she was in the English department teaching classes. So I marched myself down to the English building and just walked right into her office and said, "This is what I'm doing. You are like the most amazing person. You're my hero. And can we work together?" And she's like, "Sure." It was amazing. She is an amazing, amazing woman. I really love her. She's such a beautiful person, beautiful, like inside and out. And so she let me take a few of her poems and illustrate them. And that was my graduate work. So, and my graduate show. So yeah. And her book, The Refuge, is about the lake. And it's also about her mother, but the lake, you know, was what more that resonated with me was the lake and the birds and just being out in that environment and the surrealness of it and just the amazing beauty, but also the underrated beauty. You know, it's an unusual beauty. It's not your typical, you know, what, you know, I mean, the mountains are so beautiful here and it almost steals the show, you know, where the lake also has this intense beauty, but in a different way. And then the birds, you know, it's kind of it was certainly unknown to me that there were 250, you know, species of birds that use that lake as a migratory stop off on the way to Mexico. It's really an important part of the world. And I didn't know any of this until she told me. And so it was really, I was so, so fortunate that it all just worked so perfectly for me. And it really put me on a path that I'm still on, you know, 22 years later. Yeah.
So for people that aren't familiar with the Wasatch, it's a very interesting geography. It's a basin framed on all sides by mountains with this incredible Great Salt Lake in the bottom of this basin. And as you said, it's an ecosystem unlike anything in the world. And when I was a kid, the Great Salt Lake was so large, it created where I lived was almost an island because the lake came out to the south and to the north and created almost this sort of this peninsula at the peak. And sadly, over the last few years, it's now at its lowest recorded history for a lot of reasons, drought and development and agriculture and whatnot that has diverted that water. So I've had this long love of the lake as well. Sissy, growing up, my house was on the east side of this basin in the foothills of the mountains. And every night I would watch the sun go down over the Great Salt Lake and just, I've had this real love for the lake as you have. And even today, where we live, you and I don't live too far from each other. There's this great point that you can drive up onto the hill and watch the sun go down. I've seen sunsets all over the world. I think the sunsets over the Great Salt Lake may be some of the most beautiful sunsets I've ever seen in my life.
Absolutely, hands down. Yes, it's amazing.
When you were doing this study, were you there? Did you go out to the lake and observe the birds and the environment? And talk about that.
Yeah, I did. I did a lot of hiking out there and just immersed myself into that whole area, the bird refuge up north in
Bear River.
Bear River, yeah. And also Antelope Island. And I spent a lot of time on Antelope Island and lots of bug bites, but it was so worth it. It was, and another like really, really fortunate thing that happened to me during this time, my neighbor, he bought a sailboat and he taught himself. He retired really young. And he bought himself a sailboat, like 25-foot thing, and put it on the Great Salt Lake and taught himself how to sail out there. And he would take me. And I mean, unbelievable. Like on the western side of the lake, it's unbelievable what's out there, how surreal. And the water is pink and the sky is blue. I mean, it's And I say that and it's like, okay, yeah, sure. But no, it really is. It's incredible how gorgeous it is.
And it changes with the seasons and the weather, and there's something new all the time. And I know that there is an effort. In fact, our team is working a project to capture grants and funding to restore the lake. And so it's interesting to see how much it's changed even in the last few years as we've been in the middle of this drought in the West.
Yeah. And I'm really hoping that it's successful. I it would be sad to see, you know, that it not bounce back. I mean, I know from history, you know, it ebbs and flows. I mean, that lake is, you know, historically it goes back and forth, but I'm really, really, really hoping that it's able to bounce back. I mean, this one's going to be a big bounce back, but hopefully can help if it works.
While you were doing this project, did you know much about ornithology and were you one of the organizations that I love is the Audubon Society? And how did you prepare for this project?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I completely immersed myself in with, so I did connect with Audubon. I did connect with one organization that really helped a lot, and that was Friends of Great Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. Linda Freitas, who runs that organization, she's fabulous. What an awesome person. She's like, between her and Terry Tempest Williams, like I had some pretty awesome heroes when I was in grad school. Like, these women like were such awesome models too. So, and then I did some work for Friends of Great Salt Lake, and the Smithsonian. I also work. I immersed myself like completely into that world because I didn't know anything about any of it. I mean, I was completely fascinated, but like I was new. Like it was. But it was definitely a work of love. I didn't sleep or vacuum my house or anything like that for 2 years. But you know, it was all worth it.
And
the work that came out, you know, I'm still really proud of everything that came out of those 2 years of completely immersing myself into that world. It's probably some of my more. Yeah, I'm more proud of that work than a lot of my other work. It was really meaningful.
I would love to see that portfolio at some point. Let's find time to do that.
Yeah.
So you started, you said you had this love of teaching, and what was it about teaching art that was so appealing to you?
Probably the biggest thing that really hooks me every semester, I mean, it's been 22 years, every semester, the sparks that fly, you know, they just, it's such a fabulous environment where, you know, you can just sit there with a bunch of kids and sparks are flying everywhere. And it's just beautiful to see, you know, when, and especially like classes like Intro to Visual Arts, you know, like it's introduction class. It's a 10-10, but I still love to teach it because the kids will see, you know, things like, you know, things that they've seen in social media or, you know, pop culture. And they're like, oh, hey, you know, and oh, I know this. And oh, so that's the backstory of that. Are you kidding me? You know, so this, you know, this art history sort of thing, you know, it's fabulous because they've seen all these connections are being made. And I love it. I love to see that. I'd love to see when kids get hooked on art and love art. I'm not a studio teacher. I taught studio classes for a little bit, but that was not really where I excelled or thrived. I do better in lecture classes where I can just sit with the kids and just discuss things and talk about things. And I'm a little bit better that way and making connections. And yeah, so I think that's probably the biggest part for me is just seeing these discoveries and connections.
So much of your work is centered around color and design, and you've got this very unique style. Do you want to talk about maybe some just your own self-reflection on how you have incorporated this expertise of color and design and then this really unique style that you have into your teaching?
So when I started at the University of Utah, the chair of my committee, or when I was in grad school, you have to have a committee that oversees your graduate work for those years that you're studying. So the chair of my committee was McRae Magleby, which he's my mentor, and he's one of the most amazing artists. I've loved his work since as long as I can remember. He was actually named one of the top 10 designers of the world. He worked for BYU for years. He was their graphic designer and then taught at the U as well. And so he was my chair of my committee and also my mentor and still is. And my work is very influenced by his work and all his heroes. You know, his heroes are my heroes. So if you ever look at his work, it's really easy to see the parallel. And it's really funny. Just recently, I did a logo for Goal Foundation. And they invited me over to their office. And I'd never been there before. And we went into the conference room. And on one whole wall is all McRae Magleby's posters. And I just was like, are you kidding me? Oh my gosh, did you guys know? Like this man is my mentor and he's my, you know, and they're like, no. I'm like, yeah, I even, you know, so there was one poster. So McRae, so he did work for the Olympics. So when I was in grad school, so it was 2000, so 98 to 2000. And then I was, you know, I still stayed there and McRae was there as well. And I got to watch the process of him doing work for the Olympics, which was like so cool. So so his poster is like that were on the wall for the Olympics at the Goal Foundation. I was like, I got to see the sketches of those. Like, it was really cool. But yeah. So definitely he is a huge influence and color wise as well. He has an aesthetic that is, it reminds me very much of sort of an Eastern sort of design aesthetic, which is also, you know, very influential on me, like Japanese and the more like the sort of this color palette that is just like unexpected and unusual and you know, I think Eastern art, you know, and Japanese art, Chinese art, I think for, in my perspective, those artists, those designers, they have it. Like it's, they get it. Like they just, for, you know, like the way I look at it, like they just, they understand design and color like so well, like, and maybe it's because it's not, you know, what I'm used to, where I can look at it and admire it, but it also really influences me a lot. So yeah, I will appropriate a lot of work from the East into my own work, you know, that sort of the natural sort of design and aesthetic, that sort of almost a Buddhist sort of, I think if I ever chose a religion, it would be Buddhist.
So our work is, as you know, it's very technical. Sometimes it's very complex. And yet I've always had this belief that creativity is an energy, and it doesn't matter whether you're working a large proposal or you're working a memo or a letter or an email, that creative energy is, it's the same. And we're going to talk about some of the work within LSI and some of the work that you're doing today. But when you work with these individuals in at the university over the last more than two decades, how would you guide a student to develop creativity?
Oh, that's a great question. I actually taught a class on creative problem solving for a few years, and it's you're absolutely right. It's something, you know, creativity, it's in everything. And I think that people have this idea that it's some sort of a magical sort of, you know, thing that comes down from the sky and zaps you like a lightning. And it's not like that at all. It's really, you have to just kind of let it sort of not have this mystique and just look at it for what it is. It's something that we all have. We all have that potential for being extremely creative. It's just whether or not you allow, you know, that sort of flow and kind of let your inhibitions about the whole thing kind of, you know, flow. So when I talk to students about it, I usually say, yeah, you know, just kind of make some fertile ground, you know, kind of prepare your sort of your life and you know, your sort of way of looking at things. You can just create this ground that's super fertile and just let things kind of happen and not be so uptight about this whole idea of accepting ideas that could potentially turn into, you know, the idea.
I think a lot of people, as you said, have this idea that creativity is something where you're going to be inspired and want to go do something creative, whatever it is, write or paint or compose, whatever your creative outlet is. And absolutely, there are moments in your life where you're in love, or you're going to be inspired through beauty, or you'll have an idea and you're compelled to create. What about all of those days where you are having a horrible day and yet you have to be creative? That is so fascinating to me, where, yeah, anybody can be inspired in the moment and want to go be creative and do something creative, but to develop that skill of creativity every day, where no matter what's happening, you have a headache, or, you know, you had a bad day, or, and you still have to get up and create. How, as an artist, how do you work through those moments where you don't feel creative and you need to create?
That is an excellent, excellent question. And that is probably one of the most intimidating things about being an artist, because it comes and goes. You know, there's moments where, you know, like I will just be so full on creative and just, it's just coming out of me. Like, I mean, and then there's moments, long, treacherous moments where there's nothing, there's just nothing. I'm tapped out. And I think over the years I've learned to understand, you know, that those moments of being tapped out, drained, and just, you know, vapor locked, or that they don't last, that they go away. So I'll usually give myself a little bit of time and I'll go and do some other things, get a different perspective. But those are all things I had to learn. They didn't come, you know, and no one told me in art school that there would be, you know, those really dark days of like stress and where you just day after day, it's just not coming. It's not coming. It's not coming. And, you know, but those are the moments where, you know, yeah, you just have to figure it out. And everyone is different. You know, for me, it was, you know, doing other things, you know, doing, you know, riding my bike or going skiing or going hiking. Hiking is probably one of the biggest triggers of getting past, you know, that sort of block that scares every artist right down to the very core of their being, because it is pretty hard. It's horrendously scary when people are expecting something and you're just not, there's just nothing.
It's a skill too. It's like running. It's like anything else. It's a skill. And one of the things that I have learned in business is that oftentimes we see individuals that have all of the business skills, understand how to read a balance sheet and all the technical pieces, and they have zero ability to be creative. And really, there is so much creativity required for business, and especially what we do in our business development and economic development, social impact work. It requires an immense amount of creative energy. And I have found in the last 30 years of my career that those individuals that have that ability to be creative and can connect the dots succeed. And if you don't have the ability to do that, it's not going to work. And so trying to convince the academia in general that art is so important because of that element where so much of business in general, but especially what we do, requires that same kind of creative energy that you use to complete a piece of artwork. It's the same thing, same type of creative energy to create a campaign around anything, especially something that's very complex. And how do you even start? So my question for you is, you said sometimes if you're not feeling creative, you'll take a walk and get to the mountains. I have that same routine as well. I'm inspired being in the mountains, especially in snow. But do you have a routine or an algorithm that you use for getting in that creative mindset?
Yeah. And you're so absolutely right when you say that, you know, that there's creativity and everything is so underestimated. Yeah, McCrae Magleby, he taught me when I was in school, he had like this list of 10 ways to spark and get past a block or a moment where you're just, you know, you're so tense and it makes it worse, right? Like you're trying to solve a problem, and this is any problem, you know, either an artistic design or business problem or writing something, or you're just so worked up and you're just like frozen. I call it vapor lock, you know, and So he would have this list of 10 different things to kind of get you past. And it really works. You know, it helps. It really kind of gets you out of your head, you know, and into, and one of those things, you know, McRae Magleby was also a big hiker. And one of those was, you know, just get out of your office or your studio or, and just get another perspective, any perspective, just get another perspective and just clear out your head for a moment and then come back. And as soon as you come back, you have a completely different, fresh perspective on this problem that you're trying to solve. And sometimes the problem is going to last for, you know, weeks on end, but coming to terms with that and just kind of working through and not stressing so badly about it, you know, really, really helps. And then just going through, yeah, these creative problem solving steps that really, yeah, they do work, and they work for any discipline. When I was teaching that class for creative problem solving, I had a lot of engineering students and physics students, and it really helped them a lot as well, you know, with their problems that, you know, we just taught ourselves how to just get out of our sort of, you know, mindset and do crazy things. We used to do really fun things. We used to go fly a kite for class, you know, and then come back and try to solve problems. It was really fun. It was a super, like, it was a super fun class to teach. And also it really surprised a lot of my students because, you know, here you're getting students from, you know, a completely different part of campus where everything is really black and white. And here they get this, you know, this class where, you know, this professor is going, hey, let's go fly a kite and then come back and try to solve this problem. You know, just
like, why? Whoa. But what I think is interesting about this discussion is that, you know, this about me, and a lot of people that are close to me know that every time I have a campaign that I'm working or something that is complex and I need that creative energy, I go to the mountains. And usually, preferably there's some snow and skiing involved when I'm doing this, but even in the summertime, just getting into the mountains for me, it clears my mind, and I have that ability to think and work through some of these creative issues where I come back. I mean, Summer, my assistant Summer, for years, she's known that if I spend a few hours in the mountains on skis, I'll be back with all kinds of ideas on whatever it is I'm working on. And I think your advice to whatever that is, I mean, get quiet, don't, you know, let it come to you, get into the mountains or get into nature, and it'll just, things will come. These ideas will come, and then you'll be ready to create. I mean, that is the hardest thing, I think, for any creative process, is that building that foundation so that when you sit down and write or paint or compose or whatever that is, you're ready.
Yeah, it's creating that fertile ground. Yeah.
So we're going to get to some of the LSI art, incorporating art into the LSI methodology in a minute. But I have a couple of other questions for you. Do you have other creative conduits that you use? I mean, I know that graphic art is really your love and passion, and you're amazing. But do you have other conduits for creativity that you lean on?
As far as an outlet?
Music, or I mean, do you write? Do you compose music? Are there some other conduits of creativity that you pull those levers in your work?
So music is probably one of the biggest things for me. Like, music is extremely important for me. And unfortunately, I don't create music. And that's probably, you know, one of my bigger regrets, because I think I would have really enjoyed creating music. But that's okay. I admire music. And all kinds of music. I mean, it can go from, you know, Karina Burana to last night I went to an Alt-J concert, you know, like, and it's alternative. I mean, it's a full spectrum. It's so important to me. And it takes me right out of my head, you know, like, I'll just go full on and just feel every little thing in the music, and that transports me into, and it's not necessarily a creative outlet for me, but it's something that will inspire me so much to listen to something so beautiful. And it's all beautiful for me. I mean, it doesn't matter. Like, it can be anything, you know, even my kids' band, you know, I'm listening to them and it inspires me. So you know, as a conduit, yeah, you know, for sure. But unfortunately, you know, I can't help when, you know, like, I can't help create it, but I certainly can admire. And I think I told you this a couple of days ago, like, I'm definitely one of those people, you know, that at a stoplight where I'm just sitting there and my whole, you know, like, my car is just vibrating. Like, 20 cars around me are feeling the vibrations of my bass, you know, like, that's me. And for me, that is vacation for my brain. It's just the little mini vacations that drive to work or that drive to the university, you know, like, it'll just that little tiny vacation will help me so much with just being, you know, able to flow, you know, and because it just inspires me. It just, the beauty of how someone can put music together like that is just, it just floors me. Like, how can people be so amazing, you know, to put things together that just create an environment that can just immerse you and take you away?
Love that. A few years ago, I decided that I was going to pursue music, and I had no music background, and it has really changed my thinking and has allowed me to pull some of those patterns into my business development work, into my economic development and social impact work in a way that it was really unexpected. And in a short period of time, I've developed this foundation of music that from nothing, from no music background at all. And I agree. I think that there's a lot to that.
I love the word that you just said, patterns, because it is patterns.
It is, like, for sure. And I think at some point the way I've been learning music theory over the last couple of years has been very different. And it's about patterns. It's an old technique that has been used in Europe for years, hundreds of years, and not really well known in the U.S. It's this music theory is called solfege, and it really is about this pattern of music theory. And in a short period of time, I've developed this amazing foundation through this process. I'd love to sit down with you at some point and talk to you about these patterns and really how it's changed my thinking and a lot of the way I approach my business and just being creative in general.
That's so cool.
It's really cool. It's been fun. You have talked about McRae McElby as somebody that you admire. Do you have other artists that have influenced you or that you admire as well?
Yeah. There's, McRae McElby is definitely one of the big ones. Gustav Klimt is also fellow Austrian. He's a huge influence on me as well. And also Hokusai, the Japanese printmaker. I did a lot of printmaking as well in school, and that was definitely a huge influence on me as well. And So, and, you know, I'm funny. I think, you know, I have my big heroes, but then I'm also a little bit like a crow. I identify, I think, as a, maybe a magpie or a crow, but anything that sparkles, I'll go after, you know? So I'll have, you know, a lot of different influences depending on, you know, what I'm looking at. And I think, you know, the whole social media thing is for me is like candy store. I mean, I'm just like, oh man, Instagram is like the biggest thing. I can waste a lot of time looking at artists on Instagram, and they are so inspiring. And they're not like these big players, like these, you know, some of them, I don't even know their names, but they're just so awesome and amazing. And they influence me as well, you know, just, and I'll just be scrolling through and just go, wow, look at that. Oh my gosh. You know, and then, yeah. And then off to, I go to my studio and then, you know, and I'm working because, you know, just to, because I saw something on Instagram and I think, yeah, I think I'm like a crow or, you know, like that. I pick things, you know, anything that I like, I grab it, pick it and bring it to my studio and it gets filed away somewhere in there, like my nest.
What I think's interesting about you talking about McRae McElby is being really your mentor and you love his work so much. I see a lot of similarities in your work and his work. And so for those that aren't familiar with McRae McElby, he's a Utah artist and very well known for, he did all of the Olympic paintings when the Olympics were in Salt Lake, and also designed the Delicate Arch.
Oh yeah.
That's on the license plates, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
And so very iconic in where we are in the Wasatch, but also as world renowned artist, and I see so much similarity between your work and his, Sissy. I think that's amazing.
I'm pretty fortunate. I got really, really, really fortunate with having been able to work with him and having him as my guide for so many years. He's a pretty amazing person.
So we've talked about this creative process, which I think is so critical for all of our work. But let's talk about the graphic art that you and our other graphic artists provide for our team. And I think when I first started in our business now over 30 years ago, I brought this philosophy of I need to see this visually. I need there. And what I found in really studying good business development was that it is a skill to take a complex concept and distill it into something visual. And people have heard me talk about this for years, that my strategy and my approach, I think why we've had such success and have won so many amazing proposals over the years is our approach to incorporating graphic art into the campaign. And I used to have a saying when we would put together these really large proposals, complex proposals, I wanted artwork on every page. And I used to drive our proposal managers crazy when we would do this, because they'd say, how are we going to create artwork on every page around that's relevant and meaningful? And I'd push them to do that. And I think that because of that, what we found was the decision makers reviewing this work were able to take a complex concept and look at the visual, and it would stick with them, and versus trying to consume all of this text. So talk about, you know, you talked about your work in creating art just for the sheer beauty, but when you're tasked to create artwork for something complex, how do you approach it? And what are some of the things that you think about in building artwork for a proposal or for a campaign?
That's really cool that you brought that up, because it's something I'm thinking about, you know, a lot, and especially, you know, working here. And this is a thing that I learned in school, you know, the infographics I didn't focus, but I'm focusing back on it. And I'm loving this. I'm loving this learning curve of exactly what you're saying, just taking information and data and reconfiguring it to a visual. And man, is that fun. That is like, talk about creative problem solving. I mean, that is, and it's driving me lately. It's just like super fun to be able to take a problem of like this, you know, sheet of just words. And I agree, you know, I think bringing those words to a visual is a lot easier to digest, you know, for someone who's, you know, very, very busy and they're looking through things. And, you know, there's a lot of information out there right now. And so to have it easily digestible and to look at it quickly and be able to say, okay, this is the scope of what I'm looking at. And then I'll dive further in. What a fun thing to do. And so I'm a little bit obsessed with it lately. You know, this whole idea of how I can solve those problems, like super efficiently and do it well. It's I love doing it. And how do you do it? It's, I think, yeah, everyone has a little bit of a different sort of way of approaching that problem. But for me, yeah, it's just organizing, you know, this information and just putting it all on a sheet and then figuring out, you know, how to best take, you know, the most important information and bring it to the front and you know, and create like this sort of visual that gives you the most important, you know, the hierarchy of you know, the most important information, and then it just trickles down into, you know, the smaller details. But talk about fun, man. I mean, it's I feel like I'm you know, like back in school, and I love to learn. So, you know, this is like it's crazy stuff, and it's fun. I sit at night and I look at tutorials on infographics and how to best create like the most effective infographics. It's fabulous.
I tell these stories of what business development used to be like, where we would get these RFPs and we would spend 2 years writing 5 and 10,000 page proposals, and it was necessary to win this work. I mean, and it was our business. And yet when I was running these big proposal teams, I mean, I'd say there's no way that anybody's going to read this 10,000 pages of text. There's no way that that's going to happen. And you know, we've done this, we've confirmed this over the years. And as we have become close to a lot of the decision makers who have said, you're right, we don't read half of it. And so there was this peak maybe 15 years ago where all of our work was around these really complex technical proposals. The pendulum has swung back the other way, where most of our proposals now are under 100 pages. Most of them are 30 pages. And yet, and I think a lot of our longtime proposal team is surprised that I'm still saying, I want to see artwork on incorporated into the proposal, and even on every page if possible. And they've said, we've got such limited real estate now, where before we had all of, we had the ability to, when we were doing 10,000 pages, we could do all this artwork. And Sissy, we had artists in the office, like doing real painting, not working, you know, they would sit down and sketch. And we'd say, here's our idea. And they would sketch it out by hand and say, how about this? And they would do these storyboards by hand. And, you know, the technology now has changed so much of that. But I think that even now, it's so critical that we have this artwork incorporated into our documents, into our campaigns, because people will remember it. You create an emotion tied to it that you may not be able to create with just text. The other day, I had an opportunity to talk to one of the, we've been talking a lot about the IIJA work, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or the bipartisan infrastructure law, as a lot of people are referring to it now. And this really fantastic government executive said, I am going to make decisions to award $4 billion, and he's going to do this in the next 6 months, $4 billion of awards. He's put out these RFPs that are 30 pages. The request is that the proposer limit the proposal to 30 pages. You have a 30-page limit on your proposal. He is saying that he expects getting thousands of proposals. And even though it's 30 pages, he's got this anxiety of, how am I going to go through and evaluate these hundreds or thousands of proposals? And I think creating this emotion tied to the artwork on your 30-page proposal and creating something memorable is the key to this.
I agree. I agree fully. Yeah, it just sets you apart.
When you're often given a project, create this artwork around a concept that you have no background in. Where do you even start?
So, I'm getting a lot of help around the office. Definitely. Lauren is awesome and Summer is awesome. And yeah, so everyone is getting me up to speed because it's true. I don't have a whole lot of background in this field, but I can, my sources are pretty awesome. I'm definitely getting some good teaching from, or, you know, learning opportunities from my colleagues. So yeah. But, you know, I think this comes back to creativity as well. You know, that whole thing about creative problem solving and just, you know, that realm of creativity. And I think, you know, it doesn't really, I mean, even though I might not be really versed in government work and government proposals, but it's this idea of just taking these concepts and creatively solving, you know, this idea and putting it into a visual. So yeah, I think that maybe I'm not, you know, that my world is not, you know, proposals, but it's okay. I mean, I think I have a different perspective and I think those problems, you know, I still can solve them, and hopefully, you know, I get up to speed, you know, and solve them beautifully.
One of the things that I love about your ability and your art, and why I admire your work so much, is that you can create an emotion with a very simple concept. And some of the work that you've done, I mean, talk about some of the woodcut pieces that you've done. Those are very simple pieces that evoke such emotion. And you have that ability that is so special. I mean, talk about that.
Thank you. Thank you very much for saying that. And yeah, that's, I guess it comes down to just shape language, I guess, you know, that it's a language that maybe, you know, I learned over many influences. Like I think I've become sensitive to how different shapes and colors can speak you know, to an audience. And I think just being basic humans, humans basically across the entire globe, we all respond to certain shapes a certain way, and or the environment or the colors. And to simplify that voice or that language down to the very, very minimum is something that I really enjoy doing, and something that I have focused on quite a bit, you know, that to kind of become visually a voice that speaks very directly, you know, and very succinct in a way that, you know, it doesn't take very much to bring an idea across or a concept across. So when you say that, you know, when you notice that from my work and you say that, it's a huge compliment to me. Thank you. I do appreciate it, 'cause that is something that I strive for, is being able to convey a message, you know, through my shape language, you know, that's a very direct and simplified language. Yeah. Thank you.
Some of the work that you've done for me, which I love that Quakey's piece. I thought it was just so special, and it was so simple. I mean, just a few colors and a very simple concept, and yet there's so much emotion tied to it. And I see you are able to build that kind of simplicity and emotion with your work incorporated into our proposals and into some of our campaigns, and trying to visualize and illustrate a very complex concept like an ecosystem or some complex technical initiative that we're trying to convey. And as I think about how you have that ability to translate so much of that emotion, so much into something very simple with very simple design and a color palette, it's just remarkable. And I adore your work. Love what you do.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate those kind words. And I hope that I'm able to simplify, you know, some of these complex, you know, ideas and, you know, these.
Will you just talk for a minute about that Quakey piece? Because it's a special piece to me, but just talk about it for a minute. And, you know, I've never heard the backstory from it, but I'd love to know what your thoughts were and how you went about it.
Thank you. Yeah, that one is a pretty special piece to me as well. And I think it kind of was a product of a couple of, you know, hard, difficult months. I mean, I shouldn't say that, because the pandemic and the whole shutdown and everything, I mean, this was kind of around the beginnings of, you know, that the Quakey's kind of came about in a very turbulent sort of unknown time. And I mean, not that, I mean, that time, I hate to say it because it was terrible for a lot of people, but for me, it turned out to be a very creative time, because it was an upheaval. And I guess during an upheaval for me is when, you know, all of a sudden my creativity, it grounds me. It's the only thing that can ground me is that sort of that producing. And so the Quakey's was really a product of this time where I needed to ground myself desperately. And so there was a lot of things happening, you know, and I was definitely slowing down, which, you know, I had needed at that moment. My life before the pandemic was really, really busy. I mean, I was working a lot, and I had my hands in a lot of things, and in a good way. I mean, I love it. I love when I'm busy, but it was really, really like so busy that I wasn't really able to focus, you know, directly on any one thing. So everything slowed down all of a sudden, and I got outside. You know, that was the only thing, you know, that really at that moment was like safe, was like getting out in the woods, you know, like I didn't want to stay at home. I mean, I was like, no, you can't lock me up in my house. And so I did, the only thing I knew what to do was go into the mountains, and I isolated in the mountains. You know, I mean, every day I would just go on these long walks, and there was no one out there. So it was fine. You know, it wasn't like, you know, I mean, we were so scared at that moment, you know, any sort of exposure and staying away from anyone. Well, that's the best way is just to be, you know, on the trails. And apparently I wasn't the only one thinking that way, but we stayed away from each other. I mean, if we saw each other on the trails, we you know, we kind of walked around each other. So, but it was fine. So yeah, just grounding myself, you know, the trees probably really are a great way to just kind of put my mindset in a, so every day I would go up Deuce Canyon Trail, which is a local trail, right by the trailhead is right by your house. So every day I would go there and just walk up, and there's one spot on Buse Trail that it just opens up. Like it's kind of towards like a little bit up towards the top. It just, everything just clears out, and there's just a bunch of Quakeys. There's tons and tons of Quakeys, and they sparkle, like especially, you know, like in fall, they just, the leaves will, you know, and I guess that's why they're called Quakeys, because the wind hits them and it's like they're quaking, and that visual sparkling. And at the time it was starting, the colors were just starting to change. So it was just crazy. Like the gold color of those Quakeys and the sparkling, it was intense. I just stood there and I was like, wow. And then you were talking to me about, you know, that you're 50 years and you know, the 50 year anniversary. And I was like, wow. It, like this whole idea of the gold and, you know, the golden, you know, for 50 years and then the golden Quakeys, and it all just kind of came together. It was really kind of cool how, you know, the colors made that connection with what you were talking to me about. And I don't know if you noticed, you know, like when you're talking to me, I'm like, my mind, like there's like these little sparks like that were flying around my head. I was like, oh. Immediately I went into the studio and I just, and it took me, you know, it didn't take me more than a few days to kind of get that idea in my head onto a wood block, and I carved it out, and it's actually two wood blocks that one is the colors and the other is the line work. So you know, just print them up in two different ways. And so, and I had the idea, and I went to the print shop, and so I belong to a printmaking collective in Salt Lake. It's called Saltgrass. And it's a really fabulous place. It's really an amazing little, I don't know, like creative, like hot spot. It's a couple of different studios in there. It's Vogue Foundry and in Saltgrass and Modern West is in there as well. And so we're all in this one little building and we all work together and kind of feed off of each other. And so I went there and printed that up, and it was really fun. It was like, and it was the beginnings of a whole nother sort of thing. Like, you know, you encouraged me, you said, you know, hey, you know, this, you know, you were talking about something and it just like, boom, you know, it went. And then it just, a whole bunch of other stuff just like came flowing out of me after that. It was like, you just like released something out of me. And then it was like, you know, and I was, yeah, really having fun. And I'm still like, it's still this creative drive. I have so much in my head right now that you kind of inspired with, you know, this the whole Quakeys was like the gateway print.
It's amazing and so just simple, and it really creates a lot of emotion when I think about it even now. So
thank you.
Well, Sissy, thanks for doing this. As we wrap up, is there do you have advice for individuals in our field, especially in the work that we do, on how they can be better creative, how they can channel creativity? Talked about some of these things of getting into nature and you have other advice that you can give to our team and our clients as they try to build creativity and strengthen creativity in their work?
That's a great question. And creativity, you know, for us, I mean, we're in the same sort of mindset that the mountains and nature and that inspires, you know, music inspires, but for everyone, it's different. And finding that is probably the key. I mean, everyone has a different way of, you know, that their wiring is different. I mean, for some people, it's just the simple act of, you know, playing video games, you know, and video games will release, you know, this sort of block that maybe, you know, that is bothering them, and they can create, you know, or solve a problem that way. So finding that is important and underestimated. I think the loops that you can get into, you know, when you have a problem that you need to solve and you just keep on looping and looping and looping, breaking that cycle is key, and figuring it out, you know, for yourself. Like, you know, I hear advice all the time, you know, like especially like meditation and yoga and things like that. Oh my gosh. There's no way I can sit quietly for, you know, I don't know how many minutes you need to do that. I don't know. But there's no way. There's like, and I admire people who can actually do that, but it's not for me. I mean, and like people say, oh, just, you know, sit quietly and breathe and listen to your breathing. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, there's no way, you know? So, but that adds like this immense amount of stress, you know, that like, okay, so I'm not doing it right. But that's not fair. You know, it's just not right for me. You know,
it's finding what is the path that you need to be creative all the time. Be creative even when you don't want to be creative, even when you don't feel like doing it, that you've got your own algorithm of what works.
Yeah. And figuring that algorithm out.
I'm reading a book. I'll give it to you when I'm done. It's very interesting. It's called Bittersweet. And one of the things I discovered in this pursuing this interest in music was I love sad music. I love minor music. And, you know, a lot of people, they hate it. They hate listening to something in, you know, in B minor or something. You know, this really sad music. I love it. And as I learned all of the various keys and theory, it's like, oh my goodness, I really love music written in these minor keys. And this book, we'll put a link into it. I love this author, her name's Susan Cain. And she's written this book about, it's people shun adversity and challenges, and yet that may be a source of creativity for some people. And I've kind of discovered that is for me.
That's so cool. And, you know, and just unabashedly, you know, saying that's for me, you know, and right. I don't care what anyone says.
No, exactly. That's right. Anything else, Sissy, as we wrap this up?
Thank you for the opportunity, and I really enjoyed this was fun.
Good. I have as well. I've looked forward to doing this. We'll do some more of these with you. I love your work. I love the work that you've done for me, and I admire you and your creativity so much, and love the opportunity to be working with you. And so thank you for this.
Thank you very much for your kind words, and I'm honored to be working with you. So yeah, thank you.